In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech. Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. The ever-increasing capabilities of artificial intelligence seem to be moving at breakneck speed. And AI's ability to automate even complex tasks and potentially to outwit its human creators, has been making plenty of headlines in recent months. But just how far back does our fascination with and fear of AI extend? Matt Elton spoke to Michael Waldridge, Professor of Computer Science at the University of Oxford, to find out more.
AI is one of those subjects that's been making headlines a lot in recent months. Are you surprised by the extent to which it's been a subject of kind of big public debate? Or is this, from your point of view, nothing new?
I think in a sense, it's nothing new. I think we've always been fascinated by artificial intelligence. I mean, apart from anything else, it makes for great movies, it makes for great novels and computer games, and we've all enjoyed those. But it's the fact that this century there's been advances in artificial intelligence, which were noticeable, but not dramatic until relatively recently. And what we've seen is some, what appear to be quite dramatic advances, where for the first time we've got artificial intelligence, which feels like the artificial intelligence that we've seen in the movies. And moreover, anybody can play with it. You just need a web browser and you can go and play with ChatGPT, and it's hard not to be impressed. And that, I think, has got what's got everybody's attention. And I think that's completely understandable.
And we'll obviously get into some of the details of how this technology has evolved and what it means later. But before we go any further, could you really briefly outline what it is that we mean when we talk about AI in this context?
It's actually a really difficult question. It's difficult because nobody owns the answer. It's not like there's one definitive answer. For some people, artificial intelligence means the Hollywood dream of AI. That is, for some people, what they're really interested in is building machines which have have the full range of capabilities that human beings have. And that's called sometimes called general artificial intelligence. Some people go even further and they're interested in the question of whether machines can be conscious, for example, and actually have the same status as conscious, self-aware, sentient beings, autonomous sentient beings that human beings have. I'm not so interested, I have to say, in those versions of AI. I mean, the vast majority of work on AI is just really focused around getting machines to do things which currently only human beings can do. So just extending the range of what machines can do to include things which currently only human beings can do. And one of the really interesting things is that a lot of the tasks that people have been working on there seem quite trivial to us. You know, the idea of having a robot that could tidy up your house, you know, tidying up a house isn't something we associate with intelligence. Driving a car is not something that we associate with intelligence. Being able to cook an omelette is not something that we associate with intelligence. But having machines that can reliably be able to do that, a robot that could walk into my kitchen, find where the eggs and the frying pan was and make me an omelette, we don't have the technology remotely at the moment that could do that. And so that's one of the big conundrums about AI.
And how far back in history does the human desire or the fascination with those kinds of technology stretch? Did it stretch back to, say, the ancient world?
So there are absolutely, it does. And back in the ancient world, there was the Greek myth of Hephaestus, blacksmith to the gods. And apparently what Hephaestus did was create metal automata that would serve the gods on Mount Olympus. And that was the idea. The idea was about giving life to inanimate objects, bringing them to life. And then through the Middle Ages, there was the myth of the golem in Prague in the 16th century. And the idea of a creature that was fashioned from mud and then brought to life to protect the city's Jewish population from anti-Semitic attack. And then in coming to more modern era, there's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know, the beginning of all science fiction, really. And what Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is about bringing something to life, actually bringing something back to life in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but bringing something to life, taking something inanimate and giving it life. And that idea seems to resonate throughout history. Of course, in all of those stories, there is this danger that the thing that you bring to life, you then lose control of, which is where I think a lot of contemporary concerns about AI arise from.
One of the other sort of cultural sources that's interesting in this regard is the film Metropolis, which I have never seen and I didn't realise was quite so connected to these ideas. Can you just very briefly talk through the ways in which that film is significant?
Well, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, I mean, it's not in any sense a film that I think you could put in front of one of today's teenagers and expect them to engage with. But what it did, and this is a film from the 1920s, is it just defined an astonishing number of tropes that are reliably picked up in science fiction movies today. And the most obvious of those is the idea of a humanoid robot, they create a humanoid robot, the man machine. Once they create this humanoid robot, it's a black and white film, it doesn't have red eyes, but if they'd had colour available, they would have given it red eyes for sure. You know, the robot then goes on a chaotic and deeply destructive journey. So the film was just so seminal in establishing ideas that are just absolutely now routinely picked up, even in science fiction today.
Is it right to say that the underlying fear that connects all of these texts and these sources is the fear that we will create something that will come to outperform and even, so I suppose, take over from us?
Well, I think in a sense where it goes to is pretty much like, you know, the fear that parents have with their children. You know, you give birth to a child, you bring them up, you nurture them, and then they're not grateful about it and they just go off and do their own thing. And it's a very similar idea. And in AI, basically the fears are, number one, what happens if we create something which is just more intelligent than us? And this is an idea that's attracted a lot of attention over the last decade. I don't think this is an imminent prospect, by the way, but a lot of people have been talking about this, the idea of super intelligence, and that we just won't be able to understand it anymore, and that it will be able to outwit us, and that, you know, we will lose control for that reason. But then there's a second idea, which is the idea that we create something which is autonomous and its interests are just not aligned with ours. And if it really is autonomous, why would it then act in our interests? You know, so that we create something ostensibly to act for us as a servant, but it it then goes off in its own direction. So those are the two kind of intertwined fears. Now, I have to say for your listeners, I mean, I think neither of those fears are things that people should be losing sleep about right now. I think they're very firmly in the realm of science fiction. But it's because we've seen this progress in AI that people have started to get concerned about those. And in particular, if you go and have a conversation with ChatGPT, it seems so fluent, it seems so competent, at least the first time that you deal with it, that it's very easy to believe that we're not far from that future.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
And of course, there's long also been hoaxes connected to this kind of thing. I wondered if you could talk about the Mechanical Turk, whether that's something that's interesting in this story.
Yeah, so the Mechanical Turk is one of a range of automata that have been constructed through the ages. The Victorians in particular were fascinated by the idea of these automata. And these were just machines that were designed to give the illusion of life. And the Mechanical Turk, famously, it appeared to be something that was robotic, but a human being inside it that was controlling it. I say we've seen many, many of those examples over the years. Actually, a standard concern in artificial intelligence is sometimes when you see demos which appear to be very, very impressive AI demos, and on closer inspection it turns out that they're not actually that dissimilar to the Mechanical Turk. There's quite a lot of human control going on behind the scenes. But it does seem, you know, again, that people are absolutely fascinated by that idea, the idea of having machines that have the illusion of life.
If we were to strip away then these hoaxes and our fears, what's the earliest point at which we can trace the origins or the development of what became real life AI?
So for me, it really goes back, like so much in computing goes back to Alan Turing. So everybody now knows the name of Alan Turing. He's one of the most famous mathematicians in history. He was one of the most brilliant minds of the 21st century. But what most of us know the Turing story about, and it is an astonishing story, but most of us know the Turing story because, of course, he was part of the team at Bletchley Park, and a really crucial part of the team at Bletchley Park that broke the Enigma codes, the German code machines that were used throughout the Second World War, and gave the Allies a huge advantage in being able to decrypt large volumes of Nazi messages. And it played an important part in the Allied victory. And Turing was given an OBE after the war in recognition of his contribution there. So we all know that part of the Turing story. And of course, we all know that Turing's life ended tragically far too short, just in his 40s, when it seems he committed suicide after having been prosecuted and convicted of gross indecency. He was a gay man at a time when that was not legal in this country, and was given a rather, what we would now regard as astonishingly crude chemical treatment to try to suppress his unnatural urges, as they were seen then. It's an astonishing story and it's a tragic story. But the crucial part for AI is that what Alan Turing did in the 1930s in his PhD is he pretty much invented computers. He was trying to solve a mathematical problem and he needed a kind of mechanical mathematical machine in order to solve that problem. So he invented it, and we now call them Turing machines. Turing machines are basically, if you can build them and if you build them, what you end up with is the modern computer. So he was one of the inventors of computers. And then immediately after the war, he got interested in the idea that these computers could exhibit intelligence. And in 1950, he wrote an article called Computing Machinery and Intelligence, where he set out what we regard as one of the key tests for AI, what we now call the Turing test.
And are there any other individuals who were important in sort of establishing the foundational structure and ideas of this technology?
So Turing had died in the early part of the 1950s, so he didn't live to see his dream of artificial intelligence pan out. But on the other side of the Atlantic, there was a young American academic called John McCarthy, and McCarthy similarly was interested in this idea that machines might do things that require intelligence in human beings. And he asked for funding from the Rockefeller Foundation for a summer school, a workshop over an extended period of time that was going to be held at Dartmouth College in the United States. And he got the funding, but to get the funding, he had to apply for it, and he had to give a name for the subject, and he chose the term artificial intelligence. And the key people that attended his event, basically through them and their PhD students and their PhD students, PhD students and so on, there's an unbroken connection down to the present day. So we date the founding of artificial intelligence to that summer school in 1956, in the summer of 1956 at Dartmouth College.
And is it right to say that even though there were very few computers by the end of the 50s, comparatively speaking, by that point they had already been sort of taught to do some tasks that we would regard as being artificial intelligence?
Yeah, and I think this is really one of the remarkable things about the early days of AI. I mean, there was a tiny number of computers in the world, literally, you know, just a handful. And at the beginning of the decade, there was even fewer. You know, there was one or two computers in the world. By the end of the decade, what McCarthy and his friends had done is they had built computer programs that could demonstrate some of the key attributes of intelligence. They built programs that could learn in very, very simple and what we would now regard as very crude ways, but these programs could actually learn. They could solve problems. A classic thing to do was to take a Sunday paper and look at the problem pages from a Sunday paper. And one of the kind of problems that we solve from our Sunday paper nowadays, it would be Sudoku or one of those kind of things, and write computer programs that could solve them. And they demonstrated a huge range of programs that could solve problems like that. They built programs that could do mathematics, that could solve mathematical problems. And they were tremendously excited about the progress. You know, with these incredibly crude computers, they demonstrated all these key capabilities, albeit in very primitive forms. And they imagined that progress was then going to be swift.
I'm always fascinated when a technology appears to make an enormous breakthrough comparatively early on. Were there any particular factors or forces that allowed that breakthrough to happen so early as well?
So they were able to demonstrate progress because what they were working on was really what we would call abstracted versions of real-world problems. So they weren't actually working on real-world problems. They were working on kind of simplified versions of it. And it turned out that when these researchers turned their attention to real problems in the real world, actually things were just much, much harder than they appeared. And so just after that period of immense excitement by the end of the 1950s, the excitement very quickly began to peter out, and a lot of concern began to come into the field that actually, after that early spurt of progress, they weren't able to scale. In the event that you ever meet an AI researcher and they start boring you about their research, the way to shut them up is to say to them, yeah, but does it scale? And actually, so much in AI doesn't scale. It just means, can you actually use it on real world problems? Can you take your technique and actually apply it in the world to the world's real complexity? And what those early researchers found out is the techniques they had didn't scale.
And how long did that cause there to be a comparative holdup in developments in AI? And what eventually led to a breakthrough?
Well, really, things died down quite substantially in the 1970s. There was what was called the AI winter. And what actually happened was funding agencies in the UK, which was the main centre for European AI research, the main centre outside the US, in fact, and in the US, funding agencies just said, look, we've had enough. You've been promising grand things and you're not delivering. And they cut funding. And the cuts were really quite dramatic. And things you know, the area continued, but it was really, it was never mainstream, and it had a kind of reputation somewhat akin to homeopathic medicine, you know, as not somewhat on the fringes of computing, and some people didn't take it seriously. It was a difficult time for a long period. It's really this century that it's decisively started to work, and it's decisively started to show progress.
And is that along the same lines as the AI back in the 50s, or has it taken a new branch of this technology, of this development?
So the technology that started to work this century is really a quite old idea. It's called neural networks. In fact, it even predates Turing's first paper on AI. And the idea of neural networks is as follows. If you look at a brain, an animal brain under a microscope, what you're going to find is huge numbers of nerve cells called neurons. And those nerve cells are connected to one another in enormous networks. So there's no precise statistics on exactly how many neurons there are in the human brain, but it's something like of the order of 100 billion. And again, there's no precise statistics on how many connections there are between those neurons. But a typical neuron has thousands of connections, and it's communicating with its neighbors. And what each of those nerve cells is doing is a tiny, tiny, very simple computational task. It's just looking for a very simple pattern on its network connections. And when he sees one, it becomes activated, it becomes excited, and it sends a connection to its neighbors. And somehow, in ways that we can't really terribly well explain, and at the moment I'm waving my hands frantically because we can't explain in detail how it works, but in ways that we can't quite explain in detail, those networks give rise to intelligence in humans. Now, what these American researchers in the 1940s, McCulloch and Pitts, did was they looked at these and said, well, could we, these look a bit like electrical circuits. Could we build electrical circuits that simulate these nervous cell connections that we see in the brain? Well, there were no serious attempts to build these sort of artificial neural networks, but it became clear that instead of building them in electrical circuits, the way to do that was to build it in computer programs, in computer code. What happened this century, what transformed things this century, is really two things. We had the data available in order to be able to train these things. You need lots of data, what's called training data, in order to be able to configure these neural networks. And also, it requires an awful lot of computer processing power in order to be able to configure them. And we're in the age of big data. And whether or not you realize it, every time you upload a picture onto social media and you helpfully label it with your name, you think what you're doing is you're providing friends with a nice picture of the party you had last week. What you're actually doing is you are providing training data for the machine learning algorithms of big tech. So we're in the age of big data. You know, it's uncountable millions of such photographs get uploaded to social media every day. And we're in the age of cheap computer power. You know, the power that's required to train these machines is now abundant, and it's very, very cheap. And so those things made possible neural networks that could do really useful things. And that's what was transformative this century.
That idea of there being this wealth of data is really interesting. And this may be a ridiculously layperson's view of it and wildly off base, but is there a distinction to be made here between these systems being knowledgeable and them being intelligent? Is it that they've got a lot of data that they can work with, or are they doing clever things in their own right?
So you've hit on one of the big questions. And the truth is, we don't really quite know the answers. These neural networks are capable of very powerful things, as ChatGPT demonstrates. Underneath ChatGPT, there's not just one neural network. There's a huge range of different neural networks doing different things for ChatGPT. And so clearly they're very capable. And one of the things that's fascinating from a point of view of an AI researcher is that they acquire in their training capabilities that we didn't explicitly intend them to have. Now, that sounds kind of alarming. It shouldn't sound alarming. It's actually just really fascinating. They acquire some basic ability to solve problems and to do some other kinds of reasoning that we weren't explicitly training them to do. Well, firstly, they don't understand what they're doing in the same way that you or I do. They don't reflect on what they're doing. You know, they don't think when they're given a problem to solve, they don't pause and reflect on the best way to do it. That's just not the way that these neural networks behave. They're simply they're looking at a problem and trying to produce what they think is the likeliest output for that problem, the likeliest way of solving that problem. There's no reflection or comprehension or understanding at all. And for that reason, it's actually quite controversial in AI, whether what we're seeing in ChatGPT, for example, is really the route to the true AI that I talked about earlier on. Could a future ChatGPT, you know, a ChatGPT 10th generation, could it be sentient? And I think the answer is no. That's just not the way that it really works.
But it could be more useful for us.
Absolutely. And I think that's what people need to focus on. I think it's very easy to get dazzled when you use these. These are just intended to be tools. And most of the uses of ChatGPT and systems like them, so Google has their own, for example, which is called Bard, and all the big tech companies have roughly equivalent technology. Most of the uses of that technology is completely mundane. It's doing things like being able to summarize a piece of text, or to cross-reference two different pieces of text, or to extract the key bullet points from a piece of text. And that's kind of, on the one hand, it sounds very undramatic and boring, but how many people's working lives involve doing just that? And if we have technology that can do that, or, for example, take a rough draft of some meeting minutes and just be able to turn it into a fluent and well-written draft that isn't painful to read, you know, that will actually be a huge productivity boost for an enormous number of people. So it absolutely, the technology, I think that's what people need to focus on. It's how can we use that technology usefully? And I think we should gently deflate these ideas about general intelligence. I think that's not what I'm excited about, certainly not for the near term.
As I mentioned at the start, there's been a lot of media speculation and interest in this subject over the recent months, particularly. What questions should people like me as journalists be asking people like you about AI and its history? What things are we missing or not talking about?
I think my main concern about a lot of the debate recently, which has been about the kind of, could we lose control, the kind of existential concerns, is there some way that there could be an existential crisis? That means a crisis that could threaten the existence of humanity arising from this technology. The problem with that is that debate is, in my view, that it distracts us from some very near-term issues, which I think are real and important, and I think people should be concerned about now. So, for example, the standard way that these what are called large language models like ChatGPT and Bard, the standard way of training them is to get the training data for them. You show them the entirety of the text on the World Wide Web, every piece of digital text that's available. That means every web page, you go to every web page, you scrape from it all the text that you can find, then you follow all the links to every other web page, and you do that exhaustively until you've downloaded everything, every PDF document, every Microsoft Word document, everything that you can get, as well as all the countless digitized books and scientific articles and newspaper articles and, you know, public meeting minutes. All of it has been absorbed by these. So the reason to be concerned about that is there's an awful lot of toxic content out there on the internet. There's an awful lot of vile bias, there's misogyny, there's homophobia, there's racism, all of it in the most gross way that we could imagine, you know, is out there. And while the companies that train these systems try to filter out that stuff, the scale of it means that it's impossible to do that. And so a worry is that these systems then acquire those biases, that you inadvertently train misogynistic or homophobic large language models. Now, again, what the companies do that release this technology is they try to build what we now call guardrails. They try to intercept misuses of the technology and prevent it from producing, for being goaded into producing misogynistic or homophobic output and so on. But there's only so much that they can do. And for sure, some unpleasant content leaks in and some unpleasant content will leak out. So that's, yeah, that's a concern that I have right now. Another concern, a very real one, we're heading into elections in the US and the UK, and there is evidence from recent elections that there have been attempts to give disinformation or misinformation on social media. And in the past, that's basically been produced by individuals or groups of individuals potentially working for nation states or for organizations that want to either steer an election in a particular way or just to disrupt the election process. Okay, so my fear is this. We're going into elections in the US and the UK. What this technology can do is weaponize the production of disinformation on an industrial scale. And they are so good at producing text, they'll be able to tailor it down to the level of individual tastes, down to the level of your taste, down to the level of my tastes, look at my social media feed, pick up on the things I like and I don't like, and then cook up disinformation or misinformation stories simply based on those, reinforcing any prejudices I might have or whatever. There are, for sure, there are lots of people out there in the world with a very active interest in destabilizing elections in the US and the UK. So I don't at the moment see any reason why that shouldn't happen. And that's very concerning. So I say, the thing is, thinking about existential concerns and the kind of the science fiction stuff distracts us from those things, which are, I think, what politicians need to be focused on right now. Those are the issues that people need to be focused on right now.
Thank you. To end potentially on a lighter note, are there any cultural or literary depictions of AI that you think get anywhere near close to the real life counterparts?
Wow, good question. I think the science fiction program that I found uncannily good in recent years at portraying various different aspects of AI and how things might go wrong is Black Mirror. That I think is just extraordinarily good. I mean, painfully prescient at times, I think, not just around AI, but around a whole range of issues surrounding tech. So I think that's good. I always enjoy the portrayal in the film 2001 of the HAL computer, which of course is one of the AI goes wrong stories, but nevertheless is actually a thoughtful portrayal of artificial intelligence. And Ex Machina is a good movie. I think the portrayal of AI there, I think, is quite a nice one. So there are some good ones. There's a nice portrayal in the movie Moon. I don't know if people have seen the movie Moon by the son of David Bowie, whose real name I've momentarily forgotten, but that's a great portrayal of artificial intelligence as well. So there are a few good ones, but I say, when you watch movies, you do have to pinch yourself. This is a movie. This is science fiction. This is not the reality. And when you use ChatGPT, it's easy to imagine that you're dealing with something which is at the level of how, for example, from the 2001 movies. It is not remotely near the capabilities of HAL. It's very fluent and very articulate, but that doesn't mean it's intelligent.
That was Michael Wooldridge. You can read more from Michael on artificial intelligence in his book The Road to Conscious Machines: The Story of AI, which is published now by Pelican Books. You can also read a feature from Michael in the August issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. And if you're interested in finding out more about how AI looks set to transform our world, then check out popular scientists Adam Rutherford and Hannah Fry's series, Living with AI. That's available now on BBC Sounds. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal-Green.